Well, hey, thank you for coming. My hope is to just blaze through this quickly, tell you a few stories and introduce you to some of these folks. Feel free to just ask me a question in the middle of it. It's not like this is some formal presentation. This is my 12 days in the life of the jungle. I've told a number of you who have asked. Hardest experience of my life. I've always considered myself a fairly adventurous spirit. This is one of those where I'm glad that I did it. Don't care if I ever do it again. It falls into that category. This is Jarab and Amy. Some of you have met the McLeans. They were here in Colorado a number of years ago. Jarab and Amy are on the left. They have 5 children. Their youngest is not represented there. And then this is Scott and Tasha on the right. They have 3 children in the picture. Her 4th is due next month. She will fly from Papua to Jakarta, have her baby, fly back to Papua. These two couples will have 9 children between them. The oldest is age 9, and they will move into the jungle of Papua. Okay. There they are again. Jarab was a college student when Sharice and I first got to know him. He was at Springfield College. His wife, Amy, was at Smith College. They met through Campus Crusade for Christ. They became dear friends. I discipled Jarab, and Sharice discipled Amy. They lived a couple of doors down the street from us, and so they're just kind of like family. And I've told some of you a number of years ago, God just put this desire in my heart that when the time came for them to build their house, wherever that would be, this has been probably close to 10 years ago when they started with New Tribes, I hoped that I could be a part of that. I had no idea what I was asking for. Okay, just again, another shot of the family. That's the mode of transportation into the village of Sawa, where we were. The helipad is at the airport in the city of Sintani. If you have looked on the northern coast of that large island, the eastern half of it is West Papua, the western half is Papua New Guinea. 2 different countries, 1 island, and the town of Jayapura lies on the northern shore. It's the regional capital of that area. Down the road, about a half an hour in a flat spot, is where the airport is and the helicopter. It's a 20-minute ride into the jungle, or it's a 5-day trek to the jungle, whichever you prefer. I preferred the helicopter, although I almost missed it and had to do the trek. So, here we go. Keep going, Mickey. We'll just... All right, this... we're taking off, and we're heading about... I guess it's about 50 miles that would be southwest from the northern coast into the jungle. It's a 50-mile, 20-minute helicopter ride. It might as well be the end of the world. That is Lake Sintani. Beautiful, beautiful country. It's on the equator. It's a rainforest. In case you're wondering why everything is so green. It is always green. I think it's always raining. Just some of the supplies at one of the stops along the way. On occasion, it does rain there, yes. Go ahead, Mickey. What? Well, the interesting thing is they told us that we were at the beginning of the dry season. I mean, I'd like to think maybe it's because we were still close to the wet season that it was so rainy. It just rains like you can't imagine. And... they had transported a number of supplies ahead of time, just primarily building stuff, and then Jarab had food stuff. He was real sensitive to our diet. We ate just mostly canned goods and, you know, Americanized, westernized cuisine, if you will. He was our cook for the 12 days that we're in. He's just very sensitive to the fact that the helicopter basically drops you off and says, see you in 12 days. And you hope you don't cut your leg off with a chainsaw. You hope you don't get bitten by some poisonous snake. I mean, there is no getting out of there. We had a satellite phone that's worth about as much as a $3 bill, and we couldn't get through on the satellite phone. So it was a huge adventure in trusting the Lord. No. Oh, no. That's an interesting question, Marilyn. Scott and Tasha, Jared and Amy's partners, they've all been into the village for short periods of time. And their kids, of course, are young, and so they stayed for several days. But the kids are in a strange place, and it's not a comfortable place, it's not a pleasant place, and of course they're kind of crying and having a hard time settling down. And the village people of Sawa said, you know, your children are having trouble, maybe they should see a witch doctor. But to Scott and Jared's knowledge, that witch doctor must be at another village because there isn't one there in the village of Sawa. The village of Sawa is only about 25 or 30 people. They're part of the Elsang people group. The Elsang people group numbers approximately 250 to 300. That's their best guess on this entire island. Jared and Scott trekked hundreds of miles through the Papuan jungles. I just can't imagine doing what they did. And a part of that was to scope out the different villages and seeking the Lord's guidance for where they should settle. I mean, you understand, right? These two and their families are moving into a village, and they're going to live there. And they're going to learn this language that is not a written language so that they can translate the scripture into what's called the heart language of the people. I agree, Maddie. I agree totally. The villagers on most of the island, some of the more remote ones do not, all speak Indonesian. That would be like the trade language of the islands. But every village has its own, what they call heart language. It's their own language. It's the language of the heart of the people. And they want to bring the gospel in the heart language to these people. Because the trade language just has a lot of clutter and junk associated with it that they don't want to have to deal with. If you look due north of Australia, Queensland is kind of that jutted point that sticks up to the north. Papua New Guinea and West Papua is that large island that's about 500 miles north of Queensland. If you look at that island and compare it to the landmass of the rest of the world, it's quite small. However, what we're told is that almost 24% of the remaining unreached people groups in the world live on that island. And I've heard those kinds of comments, and I've heard stories about how this tribe has lived here for, you know, 100 years, and this tribe is like 4 miles down the path, and they didn't even know that they were there. And I thought, how can that be possible? And then I went there. It's possible. You should see the path. You know, it's unbelievable terrain. The island of Sentani, or the town of Sentani, is on the northern coast. And, of course, so obviously that's sea level. Through the center of the island, again, if you look on the map, you'll see kind of a backbone of a range of mountains. Those peaks go up to 16 and 17,000 feet. They're snow-capped. They have glaciers on the equator. So, you know, it's similar to the mountains that our Ecuadorian team members have seen. And all in one island. And so the terrain and the ruggedness and the wildness of it is just beyond description. You fly across this jungle in the helicopter. It's just this carpet of green as far as the eye can see. And then the mountains just explode out of something. It looks like something out of the scenes of Jurassic Park. You know, those cliffs and those amazing mountains. Okay. Okay, continue. What's that? You know, Jill, when I looked down at the jungle, I did great on that helicopter. You know? Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Jill is referring to my motion sickness. I did not throw up. Now, you look down, though, and you think, how does anyone or anything live down there? It's remarkable. Okay. You can see the generator and some of the saws. That was a great blessing. We built, you'll see some of what's called ironwood. Enormous trees in the jungle on the island, and they call it ironwood. Well, there's a clue in the name. It's as hard as, and it's as heavy as, and you have to cut it and use it at just the right time. If it dries too much, then you can't get a nail into it, you can't get screws into it. So we had a generator, we had a compressor, we were able to run a pneumatic nailer, we were able to run some power saws, and that really, you know, helped expedite the process. You should have seen me taking the pneumatic nailer through customs in Bali. You don't want to refer to it as a nail gun, which is what we call them here in the United States. So pneumatic nailer, the guy just looks at me like I have two heads. And I said, well, It's a tool for a friend of mine who's building a house. Oh, you know, so he's kind of looking at it. Then he opens up the box of nails, you know, and it looks like bullets, you know, inside this box. God was gracious. I got through. This is in a part of the world, by the way, where on the back side of the exit tickets, it says death to drug traffickers. Great! You know, you don't want to be misidentified in any way at all. So, this is the village of Sawa. You can see that it's a booming metropolis. I love that picture because it just gives you a sense of that's the jungle. Except for where that village is, that's what the entire island looks like. Except in places where there are villages. So there's hundreds of miles of the densest forest or jungle that you have ever seen, and then there'll just be this little oasis where there's a village. This is our welcoming committee. There's some of the people in the village of Sawa. Again, part of the Elsang people group, 250 to 300 approximately in the Elsang region. And these folks have been typically, in their history, fairly nomadic people. The people who live here in the village of Sawa have actually been here for several decades now, as far as Jareb and Scott are able to figure out. Isn't that interesting? No. They were closed. The little boy, the villager, the father's name is Gabriel. He's holding the little boy. You can see that he's naked. We called him the village nudist. He was naked most of the time that we were there. On occasion, he put a shirt on. But no, their clothes, best we can figure, is they are only a five-day trek from civilization. If Sintani is civilization, that's as close as you are. And so, in the nomadic nature of these people, they have traveled back and forth over the years. And so, these folks will have cousins that live in the next town. And they talk about the next town like it's just down around the corner. You know, it's like a three-day hike through the jungle on the game trails. And so, people pass through on their way to Sintani and come back through. And so, you know, the clothes are just cast-offs from who knows where. Amazing people. They really are. Really, really are. Someone said, what was the most defining thing that you learned? Someone has asked me this in Papua. And I say this with no hesitation. It's the mystery of God's grace and His call upon a person's life. Unbelievable. I mean, when I got back to Sintani and got to see Amy and the kids, I just saw them for a part of an evening, and the next morning we had breakfast together because my transportation had been messed up and I didn't get there a day early like I had hoped. You know, the kids are excited about going to the jungle, and I told you would have been proud of me. I wanted to say to them, no, you don't want to go there. I've been there. Trust me, it's not a nice place. But these folks are excited to go. God has put it in their hearts. And I want the Sawa people to know about Jesus too. I just don't want to be the one who lives there and tells them about Jesus. And I mean that sincerely. It's incredible that God equips and gives grace and strength and joy to those that He calls to the different tasks of life. Amazing. This is Darius. Darius is a Highlander, and he lives at the mission compound in Sintani, and so he flew out with us. Wonderful believer, just a sweet, sweet guy. Wish you could hear this man laugh. He just has the funniest laugh in the world. We had a delightful time with him all week long. Just back real quick, Mickey. That's our kitchen right there. You can see that it's got all the latest in modern conveniences. The mud and the open space right here is the dining hall. That's where we are. Luxurious place. Okay. Modern bathroom facilities. That is as good as it gets in Sawa, folks, right there. Kid's stool with a hole cut in it and the little honey bucket under it. Okay. There you can see a good shot of what a typical hut looks like in the village. Banana trees. Did I mention that it rains there? Everything is so green. I can't imagine that there is anything that doesn't grow there unless it's, you know, a cactus or something like that. Some of the lumber. One of the disappointment of the trip was is that we had to leave before we actually had a roof on the house. We were hoping that we'd at least have the house roofed. But we had to spend the first couple of days hauling lumber out of the jungle. They hire in Indonesia what are called cutters, and the cutters go in with chainsaws, and they fell these enormous ironwood trees. They fall in the jungle, and then they cut them up into dimensional lumber, loosely speaking, dimensional lumber. 2x4s, 2x6s, 2x8s, 6x6s, 8x8s. And there were supposed to be some folks who were going to haul the lumber, but they decided that they didn't want to do it. You know, and Jared's response is, welcome to my life in Indonesia. And so we spent the first 2 days hauling lumber from, there were like 14 different sites where this lumber was laying out in the forest. You can keep going, Nikki. That's a site. Next. Another site. That's the trail to one of the lumber sites. We wore rubber boots all week long. Jareb had emailed us ahead of time and said, tell me your shoe sizes, I'll get you some rubber boots. And I thought to myself, oh, it must rain there from time to time. Are you kidding? So all we did was live in rubber. The villagers, of course, are barefoot. We were in our rubber boots all week long. And you're in mud like this. And it is smelly, and it is stinking, and it is full of leeches, and it's nasty. And that's life in Sawah. Yeah. Oh, we feel God calling them to Papua. All right. Continue. Did I mention that it rains there and that it's muddy? That's it. The large pieces that you see Keith trying to move there, they were somewhere around 8x8. And you'll see pictures of, we built the house up on posts. An 8x8 piece of ironwood that's approximately 12 to 13 feet long is how long the cutters cut them, probably weighs in at somewhere between 200 and 250 pounds. I'm not kidding you. We hauled this stuff out of the jungle. By the end of day two, you're thinking, when is that helicopter coming? Oh my gosh. It's just fatiguing. So what we did is we pre-measured the ones that we could pre-measure, and we cut them on site. Because no kidding, you knock 3 feet off of that thing, and, you know, you've knocked 50, 75 pounds off the weight of that whole thing. Go ahead. They are. They're building a more Western house, if you will. Villagers don't know. No, I don't think the villagers would want these, to be quite honest. Okay. Did I mention we spent 2 days hauling lumber out? Yeah, I guess I said that, didn't I? And that it rains there. I might not have mentioned that it rains there. We were nailing all week long. Well, as long as it kept raining as torrentially as it did, the wood really didn't dry out all that quickly. This is the house site. We dug 15 holes and put 15 posts in the ground. Of course, you don't have to go very deep because there's no frost line there. So we only went down about 2.5, maybe 3 feet. But it was raining so torrentially on the day that we dug those holes that by the time we went to drop the post in, the holes are filled with water. And so we're splashing the posts down the holes, and then you want to backfill the posts. And the pile of dirt that was over here that you were going to backfill with is now just this river of mud that's just flowing everywhere. Little progress there. You'll see a finished view, or as much as we got finished of the house at the end. We were able to get the floor system in. We were able to frame up the walls and began to get just a part of the roofing system on. That's how far we got. Again, that's just a great shot because you can see the density of the jungle. Okay, keep going. That is Hotel Sawah right there. That's where we stayed. That's a 5-star hotel in the village of Sawah. That's because on a clear night you can see 5 stars through the thatched roof when the rats aren't blocking the holes. So, yeah, we slept right there near the site. This just, it's an open-sided hut. The villagers build huts with closed sides. So this is just more like a kind of a storage or a holding hut for different things. So we had tools underneath. We had tools around the edges of it. And then we slept in the middle of it under mosquito netting. But that was a miracle. There were no mosquitoes there. It might be it. You think, all this water, where are the mosquitoes? Because you go, you take that helicopter ride, just, you know, it's 1,500 feet elevation difference between the coast and where we were at. So you just go down the hill into the village, and it's malaria city. I think we saw two mosquitoes the entire week that we were there. You know, you're not laying there under your mosquito netting at night listening to mosquitoes. They're just not there. You listen to the rats that are running overhead in the thatched roof, and you listen to the trees fall in the forest. It's one of the most remarkable experiences of my life. These trees just fall for no apparent reason. I think it's because, did I mention it rains there? And they don't have very deep roots. I mean, the roots just, you know, they have no trouble finding water, so they're very shallow roots. And these ironwood trees, they get up, you know, 100 feet tall or more, and they get very top heavy. And so we got used to just hearing trees fall. You're out there working during the day, and all of a sudden you hear this crash, you know, tree down in the jungle. So one night, we're asleep. Well, we're not asleep. We're in our hut. The days are, the nights are so long there. It gets dark at 6:30 at night. It gets light at 6:30 in the morning. You're on the equator. It never changes, 6:30 to 6:30. So it's like 12 hours of darkness. And you're going a little crazy. And so we're laying there in that hut one night. I never knew what time it was, and I didn't know what day it was. I didn't have a watch. My cell phone didn't work. I didn't know. So it's at some time in the darkness that I'm laying in the hut, and we heard this, what had become a familiar crack sound. It sounded really close. And I said, Bill, did you hear that? And he said, uh-huh. And then you hear the next familiar sound, and that is the tree is starting to fall. And you hear this kind of creaking and groaning. And then as it's falling, it starts taking smaller trees with it. So, you know, now the noise, is, it sounds a little bit like a train running through the forest. This train is really close. You're laying there in the dark, and when it's overcast, I've never been in dark like this. You can't see your hand in front of your face because there's no city lights. It's the middle of the night. There's, you know, if the cloud cover is heavy, you can't see the moon. You can't see the stars. I think my eyes are open, but I can't see my hand. That's how dark it is. You're laying there, and you're listening to this freight train. It sounds like it's just right next door to you, and you're thinking, I wonder which direction that tree's falling. You know? Okay, Lord, this is it. Not how I picture dying, but, you know, and then boom, that tree came down and just, it just shook the ground. So the next morning at flight, we went out there. That tree had fallen 30 yards from our hut. And, you know, we're here and the tree had, and it had fallen this way. And had it come this way, I probably wouldn't be giving you this presentation right now. Yeah. That is a glimpse of Keith. You can see, this is a great picture of this this carrying beam right here. You can see how rough it is. So, you know, it's dimensional, but it's more like a parallelogram. So we spent a lot of our week, you know, trying to piece pieces together so that, you know, we could bolt them and secure them. A little more progress. The container on the left, the big orange tank, there will be two of those. New Tribes is amazing. They do a lot with solar. And what they do is they convert it and they turn it into DC so that they can store it into batteries. And so they'll have large batteries. They'll actually have a DC water pump that brings water from two of those. We build a water tower. You may see it in a little bit. There'll be 1,000 gallons of water. They never lack for water. Did I mention that it rains there? They'll do a catchment system off of the aluminum roof, and that will just constantly fill the tanks. So they'll have some running water with a little bit of water pressure. They'll have a bathroom. We went the entire week with there wasn't running water. We drank water off of the rain, you know, the thatched roof system. We filtered it through a charcoal system. No bathroom, no shower. There was the leech-infested creek, which is about a quarter of a mile down this steep hill full of leech-infested mud. We didn't visit that very often. So needless to say, it was a fragrant week. All right, let's keep going. Those pants were white when I began. Mary, those were the 99 sinners you sent me with from the thrift store. Go ahead. Keep going. I don't know what he is smiling about. Jareb is such a cowboy. He really is. I mean, Teresa will tell you, he's nuts. But he just loves Jesus, and he has such a passion. I said to Jareb before I left, this is the sternest I can remember ever being with Jareb. Now remember, you know, this guy's like my kid. And I grabbed him and I said, I have something to say to you. Listen to me and hear me clearly. Do I have your attention? Yeah. I said, do not. I repeat, do not take your wife and your children into the jungle to live until your house has water in it, has a shower in it, has a toilet in it. You're a cowboy. You can live anywhere in the world. Your wife is the one who is the primary caregiver for these 5 children, ages 9 and under. Don't take them into the jungle until your house has water in it. Do I make myself clear? He said, yes. Good. I think he got the point. This is Bill. Some of you have met Bill Updike. Bill and Keith were from upstate New York. It was just Bill and Keith and I, and then Jareb and his partner Scott. And we had some help from some of the different villagers during the week. That's the pneumatic nailer, not to be called a nail gun, in Indonesia. Another picture of the tank. Here we go. Having lots of fun. It was just an amazing experience of extremes. You know, we were constantly wet. I mean, wet, wring your underwear out, wet. And so either from the rain or from the heat. On occasion, the clouds would clear and the sun would come out. Here on the equator, it is so hot. And you'd just be drenched. So we were just wet all the time. What's that? Slightly. Just oh so slightly. What's that? That was flown in what they call a sling load under the helicopter. Oh, now here's an interesting story. I gotta hurry. I don't want to keep you guys all that long. The helicopters, there are 3 of them. They're the size of the one that you saw that we flew in on. They are flown by an organization called Heli Mission. Heli Mission serves new tribes. They serve some of the other mission organizations on the entire island, both Papua New Guinea as well as West Papua. Well, they have 3 helicopters and they only have 1 pilot. And he is just, they have a shortage of pilots. And he is overworked. The guy, so when I talk about windows of opportunity, I almost missed my helicopter flight because I had to take a little day's vacation to Singapore because I had the wrong visa. And anyway, that's a story for a different day. So when I finally got there, I walked off of the airplane, got into the helicopter, and flew into the jungle. And had I not gotten there on time, I honestly don't know how I would have gotten to the jungle. I may have had to do the trek. How am I going to do the trek? And I've never been there before. So because he is so booked up, that and plus there's regulations that pilots can only fly a certain amount of hours. It's kind of like, you know, truckers and pilots here in the States. And the government, Jared's not real clear on this, but something to do with government regulations do not allow the heli mission copters to have GPS systems. So they're not instrument rated. So he can only fly in the daylight. He can't fly at night. Can't fly when the cloud cover's low. Can't fly when it's raining. Did I mention that it's a rainforest there? And so you're talking windows of opportunity. When you got it, you go. And so I have never, I don't remember having so much joy. It might have, probably the day that I married my wife was the last time I had this much joy in my life. When the helicopter showed up to take us out of the jungle. I'm not kidding you. I'm a fairly stable person. But there were times near the end of the trip where I thought I could be losing it here. And it's that hard. It is that hard. You're laying there in the night and you're thinking, you know, what day is it? How many days have we been here? You know, how many days do we have to go? When is that helicopter coming? Well, it rains just about every day there. And we were expecting the helicopter to pick us up on Tuesday. He was going to make it there by about 4:00. Well, the clouds all come in the afternoon, you know, and we get a dumping of rain usually every afternoon. And we had to catch our flights to Taiwan the next day. And so, you know, you just see the domino effect. If he doesn't make it, he doesn't pick you up, then there's just all this stuff that unravels at the end of your trip. So when that helicopter came into the clearing, get me on that copter. There was nothing that was going to keep us off of that helicopter when it was time to go. That's the water tower to the right that I mentioned. The kitchen will be in that corner, the far corner of the house that you're looking at there. That's the water tower, and there will be two of those 500-gallon tanks on either side there, and that will be their water supply. Another shot of Hotel Sawa, the sleeping accommodations. The mosquito netting that we slept under every night probably didn't need, but I just like to think it kept the rats out. Okay. Keep going. Oh, that tarp that is on the top of our little hotel room that you saw there, Bill, like day two, there was an old tarp that was amongst the tools somewhere, and Bill's looking up at that thatch roof, and he said, "Hey, maybe we ought to try to put that tarp up there." You know, and this is the first day that I'm there, and it's sunny. It hasn't rained yet. I'm thinking, you think we need it? Oh my goodness. Were we glad that tarp was there. The boots in the mud. I don't know if Keith is in a coma there or he's dreaming about going home. I don't know which. Oh, one of the hilarious things, images that will forever be in my mind, is you'll see the pigs, this village. This is the great irony is, you know, the pig flu epidemic, you know, it happened while we're in the jungle. And we knew nothing about it. We got on the plane to fly from Jawa back to Bali, and I sat next to two nursing students who were from Sweden. And they had been studying in different villages, writing some kind of a paper for school, they said. And they asked me, they said, "So what do you think of the swine flu?" And I said, "What about the swine flu? You know, I've been in the jungle for 12 days. I don't know anything that's going on in the world." And of course the irony, we know that swine flu does not come from the pigs. We're surrounded by pigs all week long. I mean, pigs are just running underfoot all week long in the village. The people have a lot of pigs. You sit around the fire at night, they have this one huge pig, his name is Awen, and he weighs in at somewhere around 600 pounds. And that was the only negative thing that we heard from the villagers all week is they told Jared and Scott, who are pretty fluent in Indonesian, they said, "Tell your friends to watch out for the pig." Oh, great. I mean, he's just mean. He's just this pig with an attitude. And he's 600 pounds of pig. And so, you know, the villagers throw stones at him and they throw sticks at him. You're sitting at night in the village and you see the little campfires in the different places. Pretty soon you hear one of the women, she lets out this kind of blood-curdling scream and you see this fire fly through the air in the night. You know, they're throwing, you know, stuff at the pig. But that was just, it sounds silly, but it's just another one of those emotional things, you know, you gotta get up in the middle of the night, you know, and you gotta find your rain boots so that you can walk out into the forest and you're always wondering where that pig is. You laugh. Wait till you do it. All right, let's keep going. Okay. That's the laundromat. That's Jareb wishing that he had a better satellite phone. That's the dining hall. That's a broom. The village women sweep. I mean, all their huts are all up on posts, so they sleep elevated, you know, and they sweep and they clean under the villages. They sweep the dirt. More of our five-star kitchen facility. This is betel nut. Comes from what's called a pinyon tree. And they chew this, and it has some kind of a mild narcotic in it, and an anesthetic quality. And their teeth are so bad that they chew this in combination with a freshwater clam shell that has been baked in a fire, and then it just kind of disintegrates into this white powder. And they mix it, and they chew it, and keep going. It makes this just blood red looking mixture. That's partially chewed. Their mouths all look like this. They just, you know, their teeth, their gums, they constantly chew it. It gives some relief to the pain that they have because their teeth are so bad. That's one of the villagers skinning up a very tall pinyon tree. That's the betel nut, as they call it. That's the evil pig. And doesn't he just have an attitude? Yeah. You just don't even want to cross him. Well, that's the thing. Yeah, we thought he'd make a great meal. They kill their pigs for certain celebrations. You know, like a wedding or the birth of a child. There were some, maybe some other things that I'm not remembering, but they didn't know when their next celebration was going to be. You know, how about our arrival to the village? You know, we could kill him. And they didn't think that was such a great idea. The dogs, they are the mangiest looking dogs, ugliest. They don't seem to care at all about their dogs, and yet the dogs are highly valued because they're hunters. You know, they go out with the men and they chase the prey and they corner the prey, they tree the prey, you know, that kind of thing. That's kind of the center of the village. That's kind of the community gathering place. People will sit around in there at night before it gets too dark, and they talk and they tell stories. And one of the real joys for me in the trip was that I could see, again, God's calling to Jareb and to Scott. You know, those guys have gone through jungle camp training with new tribes. And so, you know, they know some basics of outdoor survival. But that's just not who they are. You really see who they are when they're talking with the people. That was one of the greatest joys of my time there, was just to listen to them bantering back and forth with the people. And I thought, wow, you know, they are translators at the heart. You know, they are so excited to learn the heart language and to translate it. That's one, Mickey. It's right. The closest hut is probably 30 yards, 35 yards. So they're sort of right at the edge of what they hope is going to become an airstrip. The helipad where the helicopter comes in, there's an uncharacteristically open space there. They think it has something to do with government, post-World War II separation from the Dutch control. The government may have used Sawa as sort of a jumping-off point into the interior, and so they cleared a rather large area. And the villagers over the years have kept it clear. So it's interesting. You have the village, you have this sort of clear area, and then the rest is just dense forest. And they think that there may be enough there with some additional work of maybe another 200 or 300 yards to get an airstrip in there. And if they could put an airstrip in there, it would be amazing in terms of just mission effectiveness, perhaps school, mission station, that sort of thing, as a sending out point into the rest of the island. So their houses will be kind of at the end of the village where the airstrip will be. Good? Very much so. Oh, that's what I didn't tell you, is that they had, Scott and Jeremy spent hundreds of miles trekking, I said, through the jungles, and a part of that was to scope out kind of the lay of the land, find different people groups, and they sort of used it, you know, when Jesus sent his disciples out two by two, he said, you know, if they welcome you to the house, stay, peace be upon this house. They don't welcome you, shake the dust off your feet. That was kind of their principle in determining, okay, Lord, of all these people that are here, where do you want us to go? And the people of Sawa were very welcoming and very hospitable, unlike some of the experiences that they'd had. So they used that as a way to determine where the Lord wanted them. And they're delightful people. You wish you could talk with them. But, you know, they're fun and they laugh and wonderful folks. Fun to think about them coming to know Jesus. Okay. Here's Jared chatting with one of the guys. They garden and they hunt. They're hunter, not technically hunter gatherers, but their gardens are far enough away that it's, you know, it's like an hour's hike into the jungle. To keep them away from the pigs in the village. I say, kill the pigs. No, we'd rather hike an hour into the jungle. Some kind of vegetation that they eat. I don't know. That's not vegetation that they eat. Keep going. Nope. His feet. That was a meal. That's a wild pig. The way that they differentiate between the wild pigs and the domesticated pigs are all, they were wild. They kill a pig on a hunt, and if it's a female and they discover that she has little ones, they bring the little ones back and they raise them in the villages they own. And they split their ear. So the domestic pigs all have these split ears. And that's how they know, because their pigs go out and forage in the forest. So when they're on a hunting trip, they want to kill the wild ones. Interesting, the sense of hospitality and sharing that is a part of the village. We ate some of that wild pig, we ate venison, we ate a little bit of what's called tree kangaroo. Looks like it might be related to kangaroo. I think it's more of just like a big rodent. They kill these things and then they come up and they share them with all of you. And you go, oh great, thanks! You know, oh my gosh. Yeah. There's the betel nut residue again. The dog's getting a little bit of the, it was just blood and guts that they tossed over there after cleaning the pig. That's one of the villagers and one of his two wives. You can see that she has elephantiasis in both of her legs. Her son on the right has it in one leg. And Jareb and Scott have been talking to some medical missionary doctors in the area, and there's some medication evidently that they're hoping to get a hold of that can, it'll never reverse the effects of this, but it will slow it and keep it from progressing. And so they hope especially to get some to the little boy before it infects both of his legs. This is a roof repair. Dinner. Yeah. It's amazing how quickly they do that. Beautiful people, beautiful faces. They grow little tobacco bushes near their huts, and they all roll their tobacco leaves and smoke them. Yeah, it's a no smoking zone in the village. Town ordinance. Yeah, step outside, your cigarette gets rained out. Just the betel nut. Good question, Peg. I think I remember Jareb saying something in the vicinity of between 40 and 50. And it's so interesting. You'd love to know how old these people are. Jareb and Scott they don't feel like they've gotten close enough to ask them yet, but you're suspicious that they're a lot younger than they look, many of them. That's the nudist. I think we're just about the end here. Yeah. It's interesting, you know, Jareb and Scott worked on an arrangement. They paid them for helping with, you know, hauling some of the lumber and cutting. Yeah, you've got to love that, huh? They pay in food goods, but they do want rupiah, which is the Indonesian currency. They will take rupiah. Again, because of the occasional passerby who's on their way to Sentani, they can have things purchased and brought back. We're on our way. And that's as far as we got the house. Water towers to the left there. The roof system is on. It's the ceiling joists are on for the house, but not the roof system. So they were working. Scott and Darius stayed when we left, and then the helicopter went back and picked them up. And so during that hour that we were gone, they were putting tarps over the roof to try to keep the floor a little drier, because it does rain there once in a while. No. Where the house was, Scott and Tasha's house will be off to the right. So, pray for the McLeans. We get emails from them often. It was just a few days after I got back. Their oldest, Kayla, on the left, had both dengue fever and malaria. So they put out emails, just people all over the world to pray, and it was miraculous. God responded to those prayers, and within 12 hours she was doing better. You can see their newborn, Caleb, back there in Amy's arms. He has had, or no, excuse me, not Caleb, but Katie, the little guy in Jared's arms. He has just had dengue fever the last few days. That's the crew. That's the McLeans. Pray for the McLeans. And again, thanks to you for the time away. I won't be asking again. That's right. Truth is, I'd go back tomorrow if I knew I could go back and get the house in a condition so that Amy and the kids could go. One, pray for the McLeans as when you think of them as God brings them to mind. One of the things that's really hard for them is to be apart. You know, Jared takes off and he goes off, you know, on these treks or recently he's been in the jungle now for going on, I think, 15 days with Scott and a crew that has come to help him build his house. Well, that leaves Amy at home with those five little ones. And she's only been able to talk to Jared a couple of times in like 15 days because the satellite phone isn't worth 3 cents. So pray for them. They face challenges and things that we can't even dream of.